on time with Uncaged.
Welcome to Topple Uncaged. I'm Steve Topple, and you're locked on to the UK's hottest politics and music podcast. Each week, I bring you the rawest takes on the big stories making the news, always joined by a very special guest. Then, I pleasure your mind, body, and soul with the freshest, most banging international music going.
Uncaged.
What's up, everyone? I am Steve Topple. It is the first full week in May. And yes, I have dedicated a whole 6 days of this podcast to one very special cause.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in.
Because the first full week in May is not only Emmy awareness, but it is millions missing weeks as well. Myalgic encephalomyelitis, commonly referred to as ME, or you may know it as chronic fatigue syndrome, that is CFS, is a chronic, systematic neuroimmune disease. It affects at least 17 million people worldwide, and around a quarter of a million people in the UK alone, and those figures are just estimates. Symptoms vary for every person, but people with it often experience post-exertional malaise, that is, an array of symptoms brought on by either physical or mental exertion, or both. It quite often feels like having the flu, you experience all-over pain, you have sleep disturbance, problems with your sleep, cognitive impairments. The autonomic systems in the body are often messed up, that includes your nervous system, digestive system, and endocrine, and you experience hypersensitivity. ME has been fraught with controversy. For decades, and let's be honest, often still to this day, the medical profession and systems of government have not properly recognised it. People living with ME have been disbelieved, stigmatised, given incorrect treatment, or, quite often told, it is all in their heads. However, both ME Awareness and Millions Missing Weeks aim to change all this. However, both ME Awareness and Millions Missing Weeks aim to change all this. So, over the course of the next 6 days, I'm going to have some very special guests on my podcast, one a day, giving us some insights into areas of this debilitating disease, which, in my opinion, aren't often talked about enough. So, let's get cracking with today's guest. As part of my ongoing programming for Millions Missing and ME Awareness Week, I have a very special guest today. She is an indefatigable campaigner and she is a mother. And she is here to talk about what I think is one of the issues that is often missed from the narrative surrounding myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME. That is the impact on children and their parents and what is actually going on in this country surrounding children who are chronically ill. I'm delighted to have her back on the podcast, because she was, of course, on my Sunday, the 5th of May edition. But she's back again. It is the fantastic Tina Rodwell. Tina, thank you for coming back on.
Thank you for having me back on. It's lovely to speak to you again.
I know. Behind the scenes, listeners, I just jokingly said to her, we could probably do a live stage show with a run of weeks, because we could just talk for hours. However, we have to be disciplined with this. It is, of course, a professional media production, so we have to rein ourselves in slightly. But Tina, we're here to talk about children living with ME and the effects on their family and sort of their circles in wider terms. As I said in the introduction, this is a sort of narrative which is often missed. The focus with ME is quite often on adults living with the disease, and children are often missed in this. To start off, I don't have any direct experience of this, so I'm interested for your thoughts. Is there a difference with regards to the disease in children as opposed to adults? Are there differences in the way it manifests?
No, I don't believe there are. People keep saying there are, but in my experience with talking with other mothers and seeing other children, I don't believe that at all. They all start more or less the same way, with an incident that happened, viral accident, sepsis, meningitis. Some, even after chemotherapy, will get these symptoms that come after any activity. So no, I don't believe that they are different. They suffer exactly the same way, probably more so because we're more hidden. We are not talked about. And there is this perpetuation of children can spontaneously recover. And I've yet to see a lot of evidence of that. I don't see it.
I should have said in the introduction, of course, that you have first-hand experience of this because your son lives with ME and he's quite severely ill. I mean, how has it affected his life with regards to family life, school, social interacting? What is it like for him living with this? I can only imagine, because I see my girlfriend Nicola and how she is living with ME. I can only imagine what it's like for a child. I mean, how is this for him?
I think it's horrendous. I can't think of anything worse in my life. Basically because the doctors don't know how to treat. They don't understand, so they dismiss the child. So I vividly remember coming away from one appointment and he said to me, "Why do doctors hate me so much, Mum? Why won't they listen?" And he feels that anything that he says is just masked over, that it isn't his reality. And it's a form of gaslighting. I don't know if you've ever seen that film, Gaslighting, where the man goes around and turns the gaslight up when his wife thinks he's out. Her reality was that the gas was going funny. His reality is that his body's failing him and nobody's listening. And I can remember another time when we had gone to an appointment and I had trusted the doctors. I'd listened to what they said. We tried to follow everything that they had told us, even though some of it sounded a bit wacky with the mind taking over the body and having full control and stopping him from getting better. That wasn't the boy I knew and that I understood. I mean, Angus was like an octopus on speed. He was just everywhere and involved life in everything. So I couldn't see this narrative where he was holding himself back with anxiety. I didn't understand it. Anyway, we'd gone to this appointment and I'd taken my sister-in-law because I thought something, miscommunication was going on there. And we sat in this room and they said to take Angus out so that we could freely talk, which I thought was great because by this time he was going downhill rapidly. And it came apparent that they were looking at my anxiety imprinting on my son. And it's like, me and my sister-in-law were looking at each other thinking, what on earth is happening here? Well, when we came out, my son was full of beans and it was exciting. It was just like somebody had switched a light on in him. And he was saying that they got him to do some catching balls and sitting up and down from a chair, and he could do 20 times sitting up and down. And I thought, well, this is marvellous. Perhaps they're right then. So we went home and we had this big conversation because it was coming up for Easter, how we were going to go out and start exploring again all the places that we like, going for picnics, which we always enjoyed and we used to take the dogs to. And it was his birthday coming up and we had all these plans. The next morning he woke up, he was in severe pain. I have never witnessed anything like it in my life. And he said that my face had gone black. And I was like, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go because they were obviously thinking I was over-egging his condition. I was fabricating what he was saying and inducing his illness somehow. So it was like, well, what do I do? And I thought, it will pass. It will pass. It will be okay. It will pass. And by that evening, he asked me if he was going to die. His heart rate, you could see his heart come out of his chest, which I now know the symptoms he was showing is POTS, post-ostostatic tachycardia syndrome. But he also had a blood test that showed that he had some form of anemia there, and they told me it was fine. That was the start of celiac disease. They hadn't even looked into it. And I'm sitting there thinking, none of this makes sense. So I then started to think that these doctors weren't really understanding the situation, and I started, as you do, going on Google. Now, we had been all diagnosed at the same time, me and my two other children and Angus, with asthma. And I thought that was strange that all of us had asthma at the same time. And I Googled then, so I went through the same process, going back through history, how this evolves, the research behind it, what they are saying now. And I found this whole backlog of research and how the manipulation of mental health had started to abuse those people with ME. And I was just gobsmacked. I couldn't understand why our society would let this happen, how NICE would, at 2017, the guidelines came out. And in 2005, Sophia Mercer's autopsy report showed the ganglionitis in there and everything else. And it was like nothing made sense. This cannot happen in the UK in the year 2013. This just was not possible. So you go through this process of, no, you're denying it. You're over-exaggerating thing. You disbelieve yourself as a parent. So your whole family then is up in turmoil because nobody knows now who to believe. Do you believe the choices, the National Health online? Do you believe NICE? Do you believe the GMC that keep taking doctors to tribunals that are trying to support children? Do you believe your own GP that doesn't understand anything so simple as post-exertional malaise, the diagnostic tool of ME that's always been known? Why are doctors not telling me how to cope with post-exertional malaise, what this means, how it can be supported, or, you know, what do you do? And at the end of the day, what you're basically doing is told that cognitive behaviour therapy, so we're very much looking at behaviour here, helps to support your child mentally, and the graded exercise therapy just keeps adding increments of activity as a treatment. And I thought to myself, well, this is just tantamount to abuse. It's like trying to flog a dying donkey and putting more weight on it. It just, none of it made sense. And still to this day, when I look back to what they made me go through, because if you don't follow the prescribed treatments that NICE put on, they're quite good at saying to you, well, you're not doing as you're told. So then the emphasis is on the mother, basically, because it's the mother that looks after the child, the wider family. So then your family are drawn in, that we're all over-anxious or have mental illness or have had past experiences of bad or difficult situations that have amalgamated into one person in your family that has given them ME. It's just a bizarre, bizarre world, like going down the rabbit hole and finding yourself in Alice in Wonderland, you know, off with their heads.
It's staggering, the story you've just told, and it's quite, it's kind of mind-blowing, really, listening to you. I mean, how much of the attitudes and the approach from medical professionals, how much of it do you think is to do with the culture that is within our health service with regards to that solutions to certain things are in the mind? How much of it do you think is to do with the fact that they are medical professionals are dealing with the child, therefore default to the mother? And how much do you think is just plain medical arrogance and ignorance? I mean, what I suppose what I'm asking is, why do you think, what was at the root of the fact that you and your family and your son were treated like that? What is the nuts and bolts of it, I suppose, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's really difficult to unpick, but it is the bullying attitude of the hierarchy of the medical profession. So if you go against, or you hear it with the whistleblowers, don't you? They try and come out and say something against, like Gosport, and they're slapped back. There is no accountability. So the National Health Service England will ask NICE to look at a particular guideline, but they have to fulfill certain criteria that doesn't always fit the illness. And then doctors are then taught now by the Royal Colleges that are indoctrinated with this tick exercise of, you've got this symptom and this symptom, so you must have this, and we've got a test for it. If you haven't got a test, then it's the placebo effect can help you out somehow. Just lack of understanding of how you recover spontaneously, why the spontaneous recovery happens and why it doesn't happen in ME. It's that misinformation that is put out there. And then you have the arrogance of a doctor that's obviously gone to medical, and done years of exploring and being taught, and they're not taught about ME and post-exertional malaise, and it always comes back to this post-exertional malaise and why it happens and how it happens, and it's a cycle. And there is no child that would be able to follow a cycle so precisely of activity. You have an elation, you have anxiety, you have physical symptoms that come out, breathing problems that come out, palpitations, then you have a period where that stabilizes, and then you have a period where it lessens. And that lessening bit is where the spontaneous recovery tends to happen. They're not given enough time to go around that cycle, allowing the child to recover or spontaneously convalesce, if you like, so that they can try again another activity. It's pressured into this speedy turnaround and not listening to children. So because they're not explained that, when a doctor comes, like they did the other day when Angus was having problems, and I knew it was the tree pollen come out and his asthma had started up, but I couldn't get into the doctors because if I did, that would push him further into that pen state, which would make him bedbound for a lot longer period of time. They couldn't understand why I called them out, because they don't understand PEM and what activity actually does to the body. They didn't know how to treat him. So I had this poor doctor, totally frustrated, totally confused, out of his comfort zone. So who is he going to dismiss? He's going to dismiss the mother because I'm a woman, and because women fabricate illness. Obviously, we mass hysteria, aren't we? And we're going back to that Freudian belief that the mother is the root of all evil of society. So you're fighting constantly as a woman, as a person, and trying to protect. So when I say to them, if I bring him down, he's going to get poorly, that triggers a response in the doctor of, oh gosh, this is one of those women. And they're not listening to the end bit, which is, if you give me time and let him recover, I can bring him down. They're not listening.
No, absolutely. And I have first-hand experience of them not listening with an adult, so I can't even begin to imagine what it's like as a mother with a child. If you need to take a break to grab yourself a tea, coffee, water, or you just need to relax your ears for a few minutes, then take some time now because we will be back in a few seconds. We've touched on the sort of arrogance and I'm trying not to swear, the arrogance of medical professionals and the systematic flaws within the NHS. But of course, with regards to ME in children, it has even further reaching implications than that. I mean, one of the, again, another area in all this, which is so unreported and hardly ever discussed, but it's one of the most sort of devastating areas of this, is the interaction between children with ME and their parents and social services. It's a particular bugbear of mine for various reasons, but I mean, there's some real, I think I saw that the estimate, isn't it, is 25,000 children a year are in some way affected by social services when they're living with myalgic encephalomyelitis, ME, or their parents are living with it. I mean, again, it's a narrative we don't often hear. Are we seeing the same problem in social services with regards to children being taken away, put into foster care, or children being placed under protection because of misunderstanding and arrogance? Is it by default the same issue that parents and children with ME have with the medical profession?
Yes, definitely. And I think it's really hard because social services they're run down and they're not given the funding that they truly deserve. They're taught to look at a mother, if a child has bruising, as fabricating, as a possibility. And then they are not given time with the child and the parent. So it's all a mixture of everything, the same within the medical profession. And I think it's one in five of us will have taken down the route of going to court, but it's a constant threat that they use. And this isn't helped when the researchers that are doing research on ME and children are calling us Muppets. Medically unexplained, physical, psychological, they couldn't come up with anything with the ED, symptoms, excuse me, or it's medically unexplained symptoms, that sort of terminology, because that gives the feeling to the person that's looking as a professional that there's nothing physically wrong. And you can't dangle an X-ray or a blood test in front of them, so they don't know what to do with the information. And then you've got time-short people that write bad reports, or they write what they think rather than the reality of the situation. And things like attendance at school, that's been another target. Well, when you consider that a normal child does 12 hours or so of activity with their feet on the floor as a normal person, they're 7 hours at school, they go to after club meetings, they're active. And you then have a child like Angus that can only have his feet on the floor to eat his evening meal. Then anybody would think, well, why is that happening? And that why gap is left hanging. So they don't know what to do with it. So you can't blame them for the misinformation they've been given. And it's easier just to think, oh, we'll make it somebody else's problem. That's fabricating. So we're fabricating and inducing illness. We'll just put it down as that. They get more funding because of it, and it gets their problem out of their hair.
You're very right. And I mean, I find it difficult sometimes to see past my sort of anger and frustration with all of this to see that ultimately, yeah, okay, people are just government agencies like social services and like the medical profession are often, it's ignorance by default because they haven't got the information. And I mean, it's ironic really that it's quite often Nicola who has to pull me back and go, well, look, come on, you know, sort of try and balance it out a bit. I'm just interested because you touched on education there, and we haven't discussed it. How does Angus get on with regards to the education system? What's yours and his experience been like of that? Because that's another whole can of worms which I never see fully opened as such. How is education for him?
It's really, really hard. When you take a person that is active and quite capable, and it's like watching somebody with Alzheimer's. He just reminds me of my great granddad when I used to go and visit him. He was lucid for an amount of time, and then all of a sudden his faculties went. And when Angus is in a PEM state, he will very often open the fridge and say, "What's my name, Mum?" "Well, what do you mean, what's your name?" And he's got a glass in his hand. We've got one of those fridges where you get the water out of the fridge and it's quite cool for him. And he gets very frustrated because I can't understand what he's asking of me. And he doesn't understand what he's asking. He'll then look at the glass and think, well, what am I doing here? And when you put that sort of child in an educational setting, they think it's behavioural. And they're not taught what this means and what signs to look out for. So in the beginning, when he was more capable and he was on a reduced timetable, which is one of the things that they will help you with, he was getting misunderstood by his teachers because he was this capable person. Now he's messing about in class. He will zone out, and that used to infuriate the teachers. What's he doing? So there was a big learning curve for me to understand the illness, how to enable the teachers to understand and help support Angus. And then he was taken out of school completely because he was bedbound after this incident with the physiotherapist exercising him beyond his capability. And then you have the attendance officer who comes in and starts making accusations, and you don't get the support needed from the doctors. So you're left there battling, not really understanding, because you're trying to find out so much information at such a quick pace to support everybody, the education, the social services, the doctors, the physiotherapist, everybody that's involved with your child, you have to support. Because that's what you're trying to do, get the best support for your child. So we went through a period of them, if he doesn't come to school, he's going to have to go to court. And they're saying this in front of my child. And I think the worst time is when I spent a whole year getting Angus in a good state. It was coming up to his 13th birthday, so this was last year. And I wanted to do something really special for him, to give him hope for the future, and that, you know, he could do something other than stay in his house. So we prepared him, and I call it going in training. So we had made sure that he was out of his PEM state as much as possible, and he was as fit as he could be. And we took him to Thetford Forest, which is about an hour's down the way. And you'll hear a lot about pacing. I don't really agree with pacing because it never takes into account the 48 hours of the symptoms coming out after you've done an activity. But we tried very gradually. We had a car journey. We stopped the car because he doesn't travel very well. We stayed in the car to allow his body to rest. We went and had a meal. We went back in the car. We went to the place where we were staying, and we rested the next day. The next day was his birthday, and the whole idea was to go on a quad bike experience for 40 minutes and to do bow and arrows, because he wanted to do that. And we were going to do that as a whole family, and I'm useless. So that was going to be really funny because I'm no good. I try really hard, but I'm just incapable. So we had got all this wonderful things going on, and my husband has never really seen what PEM actually means. And he had 45 minutes of absolutely elation. You could see it on his face. And the fact that he could still do something and he was really good at it was amazing. So we were all joyous and excited. He got off and he collapsed. He could no longer walk. He could no longer see. He was in horrendous pain. And my husband looked at me and I had to hold my husband up because the sheer shock of that happening to his child was, you give him this idea that you get to a standard and it's a base and you build on that base and you will never go back down is total bananas, and that he's still not back to where he was from that incident. And I have to carry that. I have to carry that responsibility. That responsibility is mine only because I'm his protector. I'm the one that should know better. I knew all the information around it. So I have that now for the rest of my life. I don't know if Angus will ever recover. I don't know whether they'll ever get any form of treatment. They've given him nothing. No treatment. No treatment for his POTS, his celiac, all these things that could support him, and they just don't know what they're doing. And I can't trust them anymore. Where do you go with your trust with these people? You know, he's my most precious thing. And I sort of agree with Dr. Myhill here. He's like a car. He has an engine. He has electronics that need to work. And you've got to put the right fuel in and you've got to make sure he's right. And I wrote a blog about this many years ago. And it's like having this most wonderful prized possession that you really treasure. And you put in the garage and you do all the stuff in, and then you go for a weekend away, say to the seaside, and you're waiting for your ice cream and it splutters. And you think, oh, that's okay, we bring it back to the garage, I'll tinker with it a little bit more and we'll be fine. And you polish it up and it looks wonderful, and you take it out again and it doesn't even get out of the garage the next time. And there's, you've gone through all the electrics, you've gone through everything else, and nobody can tell you what's wrong. So you just have to sit and look at it.
Thank you for being so honest, and you speak with such clarity about what has happened to you and the situation with Angus and for your extended family. I appreciate your candidness, I really do. The kind of overriding theme, I suppose, through everything you've said is we're back to it's the mother's fault, from the medical professions to social services to, quite devastatingly for me, you blame yourself as well. There is a movement, and I do want to just touch briefly on this organisation because they're doing some excellent work. There's a movement growing which is defending mothers. It's not just about ME. It's about parents and specifically mothers more broadly. And it's called Fight Back, with a double I on the fight. The link to them will be in the show notes. They're doing some excellent work at the minute, aren't they? And I know you're slightly involved. Tell me a little bit about Fight Back and what they are doing.
Well, Fight Back of mothers like me that have been through this, trying to support other mothers when you're like this rabbit in the headlights, when people are just focused on you and you don't know how to stop it. But they also give us a voice, and it's really important that we get heard, because at the moment they're just covering us up, covering the situation up, not allowing us a voice. And that's really a strong point of theirs. If they're getting out, they're getting a movement going, they're engaging with MPs and different organisations, building up a momentum and pushing forward that things like EDS are seen, hypermobile joints are seen, mast cell activation has come forward. There's a lot of children with those sort of things, celiac disease, all these hidden diseases. They give you information, they give you support, and they channel you into the right process to go down for education. So it's an amazing group of people. The same with Times Trust that have been there for us. Different, you need to pull all these organisations in to be heard and be taken notice of. But again, you hear anybody speak on the BBC about this. Only local stations, but those local stations are so important, do a fantastic work, and I believe that Radio 5 Live is doing a sequence of talks with these people, which is amazing.
No, it is, and I can tell you, living on a council estate in South London, there would be many people who'd benefit from Fight Back. Absolutely, it's one of these sort of unseen, hidden problems which isn't really hidden at all. You just, most people don't see it or choose not to see it. Just to finish off, Tina, it makes me very sad the way you sort of seem to blame yourself for some aspects of what's happened to Angus, and because I've seen it with Nicola, and I can see it and hear it in your voice, that despite your entire knowledge about ME and how the system views it and how the medical profession views it, there's still this default button in you which projects the faults of other people and ultimately the faults of the disease itself back onto you. I see it all the time with Nicola, and I keep having to remind her of this, and it flashed with you just then. I mean, how do you keep going? Because I can only imagine, as a partner of someone with ME, it is incredibly hard. It's very difficult. It can be exhausting. And I'm not the one who's ill. I'm the one who's supposed to be healthy. As a mother, it must be trauma in the extreme. How do you keep going?
I think it's my children. You are the main support. You are the pinnacle of your family. And I have a daughter who works in London now. She's gone through university. And I need to show her that women are what make society. And it's really Angus, the way he views life. He tells me that you can't look back on what has been, because you're no longer that family or that person you once were. Don't hold on to it. You can't look into the future because a whole load of things will change and you can't have full control of that. What you must do is live in the now and take the best that you can from what you're doing now. And he needs his voice, and I am sure going to make sure that his voice is heard. That is my child, and he is strong, independent, vibrant, and he will be the best he can be, because I'll make it happen.
I think that is the best approach you can have amidst the myriad of everything else that goes on surrounding ME. That was really powerful, Tina. Thank you so much for coming on and being, again, as I said, so candid and so eloquent about the situation, not just for yourself, but for Angus as well, and the implications more broadly. There will, of course, be links in the show notes to Fight Back and other organisations, and more information about Millions Missing, which we are currently in the national and international week of. But for the minute, Tina, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Steve, and big marshmallows hugs to everybody.
Thank you. I would like to thank all my guests on this week's podcast. You can find more details about them in the individual show notes from each episode. I would also like to thank the ME Action Network. You can follow them on Twitter. It's at ME Act Net. And the UK group is ME Act Net UK. Of course, thank you to the ME Association as well. You can follow them on Twitter. It's at ME Association. And there are full details of all the activities these organisations are doing in the show notes. And last but not least, thank you to all the people living with ME, their families, friends, advocates and supporters out there. Society may have made you invisible, but trust me, you are not. You are very much visible. Keep fighting. Until next time, I will see you very soon. The answer.